was a victim, he insisted, his green eyes going hard. Maybe she wasn't a terrific mother. Maybe she was weak. But she was a victim. Her son made her a victim.
Motive?
Sometimes crazy's motive enough. I know it's a stretch, but it just keeps circling back.
Though the ice had melted, diluting it, Essie drank more tea. And that might be the real reason you're still in that shit can. You can't keep circling back, Reed. Keeping track, that's one thing. I'm never going to not keep track. But you have to move on, too.
I wouldn't be a cop if it wasn't for that night. If it wasn't for you. And the cops saying it feels like a pattern all the way through it. I want to look closer at the suicides and the accidental. On my own time, he said quickly. But I want you to know I'm going to look closer.
Okay, all right. If you find anything, I'll be the first one to help you push.
Good enough.
They both heard the first fussy cries through the upstairs window. That's my cue, Essie said. Do you want to come in? Stay for dinner?
Not tonight, thanks. Next time, I'll bring dinner.
I'll take it. She picked up the tulips. Thanks for the flowers, partner.
You bet. Have fun, Mom.
I could sleep standing up. She paused at the door. My boobs are a milk factory, and I haven't had sex for a month. And you know what? It's fun. Come back. Bring pizza.
You got it.
He walked to his car, decided he'd go back to his shit can, toss a frozen pizza in the oven, and dig a little into a couple of suicides. Simone hauled suitcases and boxes down four flights of steps to Mies Prius. Fork in the road, she told herself, determinedly cheerful. This was just a fork in the road, and a big, bright opening for me with the move to Boston, the position at Mass General. Me deserved it, had worked for it, would be great at it.
How are you going to get all this stuff in there? You should have shipped all these books.
Everything will fit, me tapped a finger to her temple. I've got it all worked out. It's like Tetris. I never understood that game, but once a geek.
Realizing her skill had been in the hauling, Simone stood back, watched me, her long, sleek ponytail through the back loop of a Boston Red Sox hat, a gift, calculate, arrange, shift. She wore cropped jeans, pink sneakers, and a Columbia t-shirt.
Small hands, Simone thought, boxing away every detail. Short nails, never painted.
The little Vietnamese symbol tattooed under her right thumb that meant hope.
Lovely long dark eyes, soft jawline, slim bladed nose.
An oversized watch on a slender left wrist. Tiny gold studs in small, close-to-the-head earlobes. And, of course, the brain. As within minutes, me had everything loaded.
There. See?
Yeah, how could I have doubted?
Except there's one more. Simone held out the box she'd kept behind her back.
You can find room and open it when you get there.
I'll find room, but I'm opening it now.
Me tugged off the raffia tie, took off the lid, peeled back the cotton batting.
Oh. Oh, Sim.
The sculpture, no bigger than Mie's hand, formed three faces. Me and Simone, with Tish centered between them.
I was just going to do you and me, but she wanted to be there. It's how I think she'd look. If... It's beautiful.
Tears rose up, thickened the words.
We're beautiful. She's with us.
She'd have been so proud of you. Almost Dr. Jung.
Still have a ways to go for that. She'd have been proud of you, too. Look how talented you are.
Gently, Mie traced the features of her friends.
She'd have been a star, Mie murmured.
Damn straight.
It's the first thing I'll put out in my new apartment.
Carefully, Mie replaced the cotton, the lid.
Oh, God, Sim, I'm going to miss you.
We'll text and call and email and FaceTime.
We'll visit. Who am I going to talk to when I can't sleep?
Me.
You'll call me.
Wrapping me in a hard hug, Simone rocked them both.
You're allowed to make friends.
You go ahead and do that. But you're never allowed to make another best friend.
You either.
Not a chance.
You have to go. You have to go.
Still, she clung.
Text me when you get there.
I love you.
I love you.
Simone made herself pull back.
Go. Kick ass, Mihi. Kick ass, cure the common cold, and be happy.
Kick ass, Simone. Kick ass, make great art, and be happy.
Me got behind the wheel, put sunglasses over streaming eyes, and with one last wave, took her own fork in the road. Simone went back in, up the flights, and into the apartment, to face living alone for the first time in her life. She could afford it, and didn't want a roommate. She had a job, her modeling fees, and had even sold a few pieces here and there through a local gallery. Plus, her trust fund had kicked in, so she could, when stretched, dip into that. Mi's bedroom would become her studio, her workshop. Though she cried more than a little while she did it, she moved supplies from her bedroom, from the section of the living room she'd claimed. She dragged shelves, her bench, and stool. Now, she thought as she set up, she'd be able to get in and out of bed without climbing over and around art supplies. The light in Mi's room, correction, her studio, would do very well. She could bring up models instead of paying or bartering for space in someone else's studio. As she arranged and rearranged things, she made plans. Without Mi's companionship, she wouldn't be so tempted to just hang out, wouldn't have those long conversations or impulse evenings out. She'd use that time to work. Not that she didn't have other friends, she assured herself. Not best friends, of course, and maybe she didn't make friends easily, but she had people she could go out with or hang out with. She didn't have to be alone. She was choosing to be alone. After 2 hours alone in the apartment, she grabbed her purse and went out. 3 hours later, she came back with her hair cut on an angle along her jaw, a long sweep of bangs in a shade the salon called Icy Indigo. She took a selfie and texted it to me, who'd already arrived in Boston. Then she looked around, sighed. She took one of the sketches she'd pinned to her board, sat down and began to do more precise measurements of a nude caught in a crouch, long hair spilling, spiraling, the fingertips of one hand pressed to the ground, the other hand with its palm up, slightly extended. What's she doing? Simone wondered. What's she looking at? Where is she? As she worked her measurements, she played with stories, considering, rejecting, hitting. She's taken the leap, Simone murmured. Not of faith, of courage. She jumped with nothing but herself. That's courage. I see you. With no classes, no tables to serve for the evening, she got her wire for the armature, laid it on her template. Too quiet, she decided, and switched on music. Not rock, she realized. Not classical. Tribal. Her woman would seek a tribe. Then she would lead it. With the image clear in her mind, the framework ready, Simone chose her clay, her tools, and began to free the woman who would lead a tribe. The feet long, narrow. The ankles strong, slender, calf muscles defined. She built, carved away, brushed, sprayed the clay with water, smoothed the knees. As the figure emerged, she worked her way up the body until she realized the light had changed. Evening was sliding in. She covered the figure, made herself get off the stool, walk, stretch, A little wine, she decided, then ordered in Chinese because if she went back to work, she'd forget to eat. Forget to eat, hydrate, move. The work often showed the neglect. She spent her first night alone drinking wine, rotating it with water, eating noodles and stir-fried pork, and bringing her vision to life. For 3 weeks, she followed the same routine. Work, the sort that brought a paycheck with it. Class, work, the sort that fed her soul. After a 15-hour day, much of it on her feet, she came home to the creeping silence of her apartment. She missed me like a limb. She couldn't deny it. But that wasn't the core of the problem. She sat, studying the sculpture she'd begun that first night. It was good. Really good. One of the best pieces she'd done. But she couldn't make herself take it to the gallery. "Because I need it," she said aloud. "She's telling me something, and has been all along. I'm talking to myself." She sighed, tipped her head back. "So what? So what? I have something to say, too. It's time to take a leap. I've done what I came to New York to do. It's time to move on." She closed her eyes. No more waiting tables. No more modeling for a fee or for supplies or for class time. I'm an artist, goddammit. She had another 2 months on the lease. She'd either tough it out or eat the cost. Eat it, she decided. She pulled out her phone, saw the time, and calculated the odds Cece was still up. She waited, and when her grandmother's voice came on, clear and alert, smiled.
"Having a party?"
"No, and I know it's late."
"Never to."
"Exactly. So I think it's time I had a taste of Europe. Do you know anybody, say, in Florence with a flat to rent?"
"Baby doll, I know everybody everywhere. How about we take a trip and I introduce you?"
The smile turned into a laugh.
"How about I pack?"
During the 18 months Simone spent in Florence, she learned the language, grew tomatoes and geraniums on the tiny balcony of her flat overlooking Piazza San Marco, and took an Italian lover named Dante. Dante, absurdly handsome, played the cello and liked making Simone pasta. As he traveled with the symphony, their relationship didn't crowd her and left her all the time she needed to devote to her work. The fact that he had other women on his travels didn't concern her. For her, Dante was part of a lovely interlude of sun, sex, and sculpting. She'd given herself this time and place, saturating herself with all it offered. She studied, spent time with artists, with masters, with artisans and technicians, and sweated on the pouring floor of a foundry to learn more about casting in bronze. As she learned, experimented, discovered, she built enough confidence to wheedle her way into a show at a trendy art gallery, then spent 4 months completing more pieces for what she called gods and goddesses. Simone invited her family out of duty. They declined, but sent 2 dozen red roses to the gallery with a card wishing her luck. Helping load in her art and debating with the gallery manager on placement ate up any time for nerves. She'd already told herself countless times if the show failed, it meant she wasn't good enough. Yet. It didn't mean she'd go home a failure. Her parents might... Correction, would, she thought as she debated again between a severe and serious black dress and a bold, sexy red one, think her a failure. But she would never meet their standards anyway. They had Natalie for that. She'd forever be their college dropout daughter who threw away all the advantages they'd offered her. Her mother would vote for the black, Simone thought. Be sedate. Be sophisticated. She went for the red and worked it with killer heel gold sandals that would make her feet weep. But they'd show off the toes painted the same pomegranate as her base hair color. She'd added streaks and sweeps of turquoise, plum, flame to that base to set off her haircut of varying angles. To add more bohemian, she added cascading gold discs to her ears and an army of bangles on her arm.
Trying too hard? Maybe the black after all.
Before she could snatch it out of the wardrobe, her buzzer sounded. Another delivery from Dante, she decided, as she clipped from the bedroom through her parlor, already fragrant with the white roses he'd sent the night before, the red lilies that morning, the orchids in the early afternoon, and the pink tulips after that. She opened the door, squealed, and threw her arms around her grandmother.
Cece! Cece, you're here!
Where else would I be?
You came! You came all this way!
Wild horses, Cara. Wild, wild horses.
Oh, come in, sit down. Did you just get here? Let me get your bag.
I came straight here, but don't worry. I'm staying with Francesca and Isabel.
No, no, they can't have you. You have to stay here, please.
Cece shook back the hair that fell past her shoulder blades, now in burnished copper.
I'd love a threesome with that luscious Italian pastry of yours, but it's too awkward when one of the three's my grandbaby.
Dante's in Vienna. The schedule just didn't click.
But he's everywhere.
She opened her arms to the room full of flowers.
The man's a romantic. Then if it's just you and me, I'm happy to stay. I'll let Francesca and Isabel know. They're coming tonight, and I'm going to take us all out to celebrate after.
God!
Beaming, Cece let herself soak in her greatest treasure.
Just look at you. Your hair's a work of art. And that dress!
I was just thinking I should change. I have a black dress that might...
Cliched, expected. Don't be.
Really? Are you sure?
You look bold and confident and ready. But do yourself a favor and take the shoes off until we leave. How long do we have?
We've got over an hour.
Good. Time enough for you to get me a glass of wine before I make myself beautiful.
You're the most beautiful woman in the world. I can't tell you what it means to me that you'd come for this. For me.
No tears.
Cece tapped a finger to Simone's nose.
Your eyes look fantastic. In fact, I'm going to have you do my makeup. After wine.
After stepping out of her shoes, Simone padded over to the kitchen, chose a local red, tossed together a quick plate of cheese and bread and olives.
I know it's not an important show, she began.
Stop that right now. No negative vibes allowed. They're all important, and this one is especially. It's yours. It's your first European show.
Opening the balcony doors, Cece took one of the metal chairs, then the wine Simone set on the table beside her.
Salute, my treasure.
Simone clinked glasses with Cece.
I'm grateful for the chance. I just don't want to overdo my expectations.
Well, I can see I'm sure as hell needed here to keep you from dimming your own star. It's going to shine tonight, trust me there. You know I'm a little bit psychic. And you're going to let it shine, or I'll have to kick your ass.
I'm so glad you're here. How long can you stay?
I'm taking a couple of weeks to catch up with you, some friends, do some painting.
It's a beautiful city,
Cece murmured, looking out at the piazza, the red tile roofs and sun-washed stucco.
Is it your place, Simone?
I love it. I love the light and the people, the art.
The air breathes art here. I love the color and the history, the food, the wine. I think being here didn't just open something in me, but fed it.
And who feeds body and soul better than the Italians? And still?
And still. While it's a place I'll need to come back to, it's not mine. If you can stay 3 weeks, I'll fly back with you. I'm ready.
Then I'll stay.
At the opening, Simone played her part, making conversation in Italian and English, answering questions about particular pieces. People wandered in, milled around. She knew many came for the little cups of wine. But they came. She greeted Francesca and Isabel when they arrived, exchanged warm hugs and kisses with the longtime couple who'd taken her under their wings when she'd arrived in Florence. The gallery manager, a woman of 50 who made severe and sober black look spectacular, slipped up and murmured in Simone's ear,
"We have just sold your Awakened."
Simone opened her mouth, but nothing came out. The piece, one of the few she'd chosen to do in bronze, had involved weeks of planning and countless second guesses about the pose, the medium, and then the price the gallery set. And now the figure of a woman half rising from a bed of flowers, one arm stretched up as if to take the sun, the hint of a smile Simone had agonized over getting exactly right, belonged to someone.
Who? Oh God, don't tell me my grandmother bought her.
She did not.
Come and meet who did.
Her ears buzzed when she walked through the serpentine layout of the gallery to meet the businessman and his stylish wife who'd given Simone her first major sale. Then the buzzing gave way to cheering inside as she shook hands, chatted. She had to tell Cece. She worked her way through, finally found Cece standing by a piece she'd titled Emergence. While she considered the bronze her most complicated and difficult piece in the show, this was her personal favorite, because it held her heart. The female head and shoulders rose out of a pool, the head tipped back, the hair flowing down, sleek and wet, the eyes closed, the face rapturous. She'd done it in pale blues.
Cece, what's wrong?
Seeing tears in her grandmother's eyes, she rushed forward.
You're not feeling well? Do you need air? Do you need some water?
No.
No.
Cece gripped her hand.
Step outside with me a minute before I embarrass myself.
Okay, here.
She slipped an arm around Cece's waist, guided her out.
It's hot and crowded. I'm going to find you a chair.
I'm fine, I'm fine. Jesus, don't treat me like an old lady. I just need a second.
Outside, the air smelled of flowers and food. People sat on the patio of the restaurant across the street, enjoying dinner, conversation. A woman walked by, long legs in a short skirt, with a dog on a leash.
I knew you were talented. I knew it would be clay. I'm a little bit psychic, as you know.
Cece took the wine Simone had forgotten she held, sipped.
I could see your work moving when I visited last fall, and you've sent me pictures, videos. But they don't show it, my baby. They don't show it like this, like seeing it. The textures, the details, the feeling. There's so much brilliance here, I can't begin, and you've barely started.
Cece patted away tears.
I'm telling you this, artist to artist, so don't give me any crap when I say that your emergence has to be mine. I'm buying it not because you're my granddaughter. I'm buying it because it made me weep. It touched my soul.
It's Tish.
Yes, I know. And she and you touched my soul.
Then it's a gift.
No, it will not be a gift. You can give me something else, but not that. Now go in there and tell them it's sold before somebody buys it out from under me. I need to drink this wine and pull myself together. Hurry up!
I'll be right back.
When she came back, she found Cece leaning against the wall, smiling.
I've still got it. The most charming man, not much older than you, stopped and offered to buy me a real glass of wine. We should go back in before I create a sexual disturbance.
Now I need a minute. Cece.
She groped for her grandmother's hand.
Cece, I've sold 4 pieces. 5, she corrected. 5 with yours. Anna Teresa is thrilled. I swear I almost took a page out of your book, almost lit candles and tried to do a spell so I could sell one and not humiliate myself.
No witchcraft for your own gain.
Sipping with one hand, Cece squeezed Simone's with the other.
It's tacky.
Right. Dante's going to be pretty pleased as he was the model for 2 of the sales.
And the night's not over.
When this part is, we're going to have ourselves one hell of a celebration.
And look who's going to be raising glasses with us.
Who? Simone looked in the direction Cece pointed. She saw the woman running, short black bob bouncing. Sneakers, a backpack.
Me? Oh, God, me!
Despite the heels, Simone sprinted to meet her.
My flight from London was delayed. I didn't have time to change. I'm a mess. I'm here. I'm not too late.
The breathless volley of words came with hugs.
But you had that conference. You're speaking. You...
I've only got tonight. I have to fly back first thing in the morning.
Geez, you look fabulous. I'm not worthy.
Dr. Jung.
My Dr. Jung.
She pulled her over to Cece, embraced them both.
This is the best night of my life.
Chapter 9. In the 18 months and 3 weeks Simone spent in Florence, Patricia Hobart killed 3 people. Killing Hilda Barclay, who'd cradled her dying husband of 47 years in her arms during the attack, meant traveling to Tampa, where Hilda had moved to be closer to her daughter. But Patricia considered the time and expense worth it. She thoroughly resented the press Hilda generated, especially after Hilda created a scholarship for underprivileged youths in her husband's name. Underprivileged my ass, Patricia thought. Freeloaders and assholes, coddled by whiny liberal do-gooders. Plus, her target gave her 10 days away from the nasty Maine winter, and her will-they-ever-just-die grandparents. She did her research, of course, before she kissed her annoyingly long-lived grandparents goodbye, and headed off on what everyone agreed was a well-deserved vacation. Maybe they'd both die in their sleep before she got back, and the equally detestable cat her grandmother spoiled like a baby would eat their eyeballs. A girl had to have her dreams. She loved Florida, and that surprised her. She loved the sun and the palm trees, the blue of the sky and the water. As she studied the view from her hotel suite, why not splurge, and took pictures to send home, she imagined living there. She might consider it, if it wasn't for all the old people. And Jews. She'd consider it anyway. In any case, she found it ridiculously simple to stalk Hilda and case the 2-bedroom bungalow she lived in, on the same block as her daughter's family. Within 3 days, she concluded she had Hilda's daily routine down pat. The old bat lived a simple life. She liked to garden, had several bird feeders she kept stocked, and rode a 3-wheeled bike around the neighborhood like some wrinkled toddler. On the 4th day, with ideas of tragic gardening or biking accidents in the hopper, Patricia cruised by as Hilda filled a bird feeder built to replicate a restaurant, complete with flower-boxed windows and a sign proclaiming Food for Feathers. She pulled over, patted her short black wig, adjusted her amber-lensed sunglasses, then got out of the car.
"Excuse me, ma'am?"
Hilda, spry and wiry in her floppy-brimmed hat, turned.
"Can I help you? I hope this isn't too odd, but can you tell me where you got that adorable birdhouse? My mother would just love it."
"Oh."
With a laugh, Hilda gestured Patricia closer.
"Is she a bird lover?"
"Big time.
Gosh, it's even cuter up close. Is it one of a kind?"
"It's local work, but the shop that carries them has others like it. The birdhouse."
She proceeded to give Patricia detailed directions, which Patricia dutifully tapped into her phone.
"This is great. I think I saw you drive by yesterday."
Patricia's smile froze for a bare instant.
"You probably did. My parents are just getting settled into a house a few blocks away. I'm running errands for them. They just couldn't take the winters in St. Paul anymore."
"I hear that. I escaped the winters in Maine."
"Then you'd know,"
Patricia said with a laugh. If I can find something like this, it would be a great housewarming gift for Mom.
My favorite is in the back, so I can see it from the kitchen window. It's an English cottage.
You're kidding me!
Inspired, Patricia lifted her hands. My mother was raised in an English cottage in the Lake District. She moved to the States as a young teenager.
An English cottage bird feeder? She'd just love that.
They can nest in it, too. Come on back, I'll show you.
Oh, you're so kind. If it's not too much trouble.
Happy to.
As they walked, Hilda waved to a man who came out of the house next door.
Hi there, Pete.
Morning, Hilda. I'm heading out on a grocery run. You need anything?
I'm good, thanks.
Your parents will love it here, she added as they rounded the side of the house.
I hope so. I'm going to miss them like crazy, but I hope so.
Can't kill her now, Patricia thought. Car's out front. Stupid neighbor.
Oh, what a beautiful lanai. I bet you can swim year-round.
And do, Hilda confirmed. Every morning before breakfast.
Patricia smiled.
That's why you're in such wonderful shape.
She oohed and awed over the ridiculous bird feeder, complimented the garden, the lanai plants and pots, and thanked the soon-to-be-dead woman profusely. She didn't follow the directions to the birdhouse, but hit a Walmart for a toaster and an extension cord. Promptly at 7:15 the next morning, Hilda walked out of the house, onto the lanai, shed a blue terry cloth robe, and slipped into the pool in her simple chocolate-brown tank suit. While she did her smooth, easy laps, Patricia stepped onto the lanai through its unlocked screen door, plugged the extension cord into the wall socket on the back of the house, and tossed the toaster into the pool. She watched Hilda's body flop as the water flashed, watched it float face down as she unplugged the cord, use the pool net to scoop out the toaster. They'd figure it out, probably, but why give them any help? She stuck the murder weapons into her backpack and, dressed in her running capris, a tank, and a ball cap, jogged 3 blocks to her rental car. She tossed the toaster in a dumpster behind a restaurant, dumped the extension cord a couple miles away in the parking lot of a strip mall. That done, she stuffed her auburn wig back in her pack, went back to her hotel to enjoy a hearty room-service breakfast of a spinach omelet, turkey bacon, berries, and fresh orange juice. She wondered who'd find Hilda floating. Her daughter? One of the grandkids? Good neighbor Pete? Maybe she'd keep an eye on the local papers. But for the moment, she decided, without irony, to spend the rest of the day by the hotel pool. Her grandparents failed to accommodate her by dying in their sleep. She settled for indulging herself with dreams of various methods of killing them. Actually killing them had to wait, but her father obliged her by getting hammered before getting behind the wheel of his Ford pickup. He took a mother of two and her teenage son with him when he crossed the center line and plowed into their compact, but those were the breaks to Patricia's mind. Now she could cross another off her list. She'd crossed Frederick Mosby off the list on a balmy summer night, pre-Hilda, with an explosive device she'd stuck under the driver's seat of his unlocked car. That checkmark especially pleased her, as Mosby had some minor local success with a self-published book he'd written about the Down East Mall. And more, it was the first time she'd built a bomb. She thought she had a knack for it. She checked off her third for the year, had to spread them out a while longer, by bumping into him in a crowded bar and jabbing him with a syringe of botulinum toxin. It seemed poetic, as Dr. David Wu, who'd been having pre-dinner drinks with his wife and another couple at the upscale restaurant and had been credited with having saved lives on that fateful night, was a cosmetic surgeon. Patricia figured since he made a living, a rich one, injecting people with Botox, he could die being injected with the same basic substance. She disposed of the syringe on the way home and slipped quietly into the house. For a moment, a sweet, sweet moment, she thought her prayers had been answered. Her grandmother lay on the floor of the foyer, moaning, so still breathing, but that could be remedied. On another moan, her grandmother turned her head.
Patty. Patty.
God, she hated that nickname.
Thank God. I fell. I hit my head. I think I broke my hip.
Could be finished, Patricia thought. She just had to place a hand over the old bitch's mouth, pinch her nose closed, and...
Agnes, I can't find the remote. Where did you...
Her grandfather shuffled out of the first floor master suite, brow furrowed in annoyance over his bifocals. He saw his wife, let out a cry, and Patricia acted fast.
Oh my God, Graham!
She lunged forward, dropped to her knees, gripped her grandmother's hand.
I fell. I fell.
It's all right. It's going to be all right.
She yanked her phone out of her purse, hit 911.
I need an ambulance.
She rattled off the address, careful to put a good shake into her voice.
My grandmother fell. Hurry, please hurry. Grandpa, get Grandma a blanket. She's shivering. Get the throw off the sofa. I think she's in shock. Hold on, Graham. I'm right here.
So the night wouldn't be a lucky twofer, Patricia thought as she gently, so gently, stroked her grandmother's cheek. But a broken hip, hopefully, and an 83-year-old woman had lots of potential. Patricia hid her bitter disappointment when Agnes recovered. And she earned the admiration of the medical staff, the aides, and the neighbors with every performance of devoted caregiving. She used the time to persuade her grandparents to not only give her power of attorney, the lawyers agreed, but to put her name on every account, checking, investments, the main residence, and the vacation home investment property they owned on Cape May. As she'd inherit her grandmother's jewelry anyway, she took some pieces now and again and converted them into cash on drives to Augusta or Bangor, and once on a weekend holiday, at the urging of the doctors, to Bar Harbor. She converted some of the cash into good fake identification and used that to open a small bank account and to rent a safe deposit box in a bank in Rochester, New Hampshire. Between the jewelry, the regular skimming, the sale of the vacation home her grandparents were too stupid to know they signed off on, she had more than $3 million in the box, along with 4 fake IDs, including passports and credit cards. She kept a cool $100,000 in cash with other essentials in a run-for-the-hills bag in the top of her closet, and had started a second bag. As neither of her grandparents used the steps any longer, she had the entire second floor to herself. She installed police locks on her master suite, and the guest suite she used as a workshop. If the weekly housekeeper found it odd the second floor was off limits, she said nothing. She was paid well, and it meant less work. As the next anniversary of the Down East Mall approached, Patricia made plans. Lots of plans. And crossed a couple more off the list. Selena McMullen rode the approach to July 22nd on her blog and on her talk show. It gave her a chance to hype the updated edition of her book. She didn't quibble over the fact that the tragedy had made her career. As a matter of routine, every time a lunatic shot up a public place, she served as a talking head on cable TV. She did the circuit every couple of years and raked in decent speaking fees. She'd copped a gig as executive producer on a well-received documentary about the shooting, and, when things were really cooking, snagged a small guest shot on Law & Order SVU. It ebbed and flowed, she could admit that. Every anniversary, she pumped it up and she'd be front and center. She had staff, an agent, a hot boyfriend, after a brief marriage and a messy divorce. Still, the divorce and the hot boyfriend had bumped up the ratings and clicks. They'd go through the roof with the lineup she had for the anniversary week. She had the cop who'd taken out Hobart. Admittedly, Selena had to pressure the mayor to pressure the cop's captain to pressure the cop, but she had her. She couldn't get the once teenage hero, now the cop's partner, and that stuck in her throat. Portland PD had given her a choice, one or the other, not both. She'd gone with the female cop, the first on scene, and let the other go. She had a woman who'd been in the theater and nearly died, and lived with facial scarring and brain trauma. She'd booked the geek who'd saved a store full of people by barricading them in a back room. Some other victims, an EMT, one of the ER doctors from that night. But the shining jewel, the sister of the shooter, the baby sister of the ringleader. She had Patricia Jane Hobart. Even with that, and that was huge, as Hobart's sister had never to date given a formal interview, Selena stalked around her office fuming. She wanted the damn hat trick. The cop, Hobart's sister, and Simone Knox, the 911 caller who'd first alerted the police so McVie took Hobart out. The bitch wouldn't even take her calls. Had actually had some asshole lawyer send her a cease and desist when she'd tracked Simone down at an art gallery in New York. A public event, Selena thought now. And she'd had a perfect First fucking Amendment right to stick a mic in her face. She didn't appreciate being kicked out of the gallery for doing her job. She'd written a blistering editorial on the treatment she'd received and on the bitch herself. And would have printed it, too, if her ex, before he found out about the boyfriend and became her ex, hadn't convinced her it would make her look like the bitch. She hated knowing he'd had that right. Well, she could play that 911 call, and would. She could toss Simone Knox's name around and maybe insinuate that, as a somewhat celebrated artist, Miss Knox no longer wanted an association with the tragedy of Down East Mall.
Work on that, she murmured. Work on how to say it. Throwing shade at her, but keeping the high road. The sympathy road.
She wrenched open her door, shouted,
Marley! Where the hell is my macchiato?
Lucas should be back with it any minute.
For Christ's sake! Find out where Simone Knox is and where she's going to be next week.
Oh, Ms. McMullen, the lawyer—
Selena whirled around, making the mousy Marley jump back a step.
Did I ask you what the fuck? Just find out. I want to know where she is when I interview Patricia Hobart and the cop who killed her brother. And I want then and now pictures of her. Move your ass, Marley.
Selena slapped the door closed.
We'll see who wins this round. She muttered.
Simone won. She spent the weeks surrounding the anniversary traveling in Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada. She did sketches, took photos of the desert, the canyons, the people, imagined translating those colors, textures, shapes, those faces and forms into art with clay. She basked in the solitude, reveled in exploring a land as different to her eye from the east coast of Maine as Mars was from Venus. With no one to answer to but her own whims, she stopped when and where she liked, stayed as long as it suited her. When she finally headed east, she detoured north through Wyoming into Montana, where she bought more sketchbooks and gave in to an impulse for cowboy boots. By the time she crossed the Maine border, the calendar had flipped to August, and despite the constant use of sunblock and a hat, she was tanned, her hair sun-streaked, and her mood high and happy. She wanted to get to work, to sort through the hundreds of sketches and photos, the ideas and visions. She wanted to feel clay under her hands. She considered texting Cece, then decided to surprise her instead. After a stop for a bottle of champagne, hell, make it two, she planned to drive straight to the ferry. But a twinge of guilt had her changing directions. She She'd just stop off at her parents' house. A quick courtesy call. Maybe her relationship with her parents and her sister remained strained, but she couldn't claim to be blameless. Since the day she'd walked out of her childhood home to pursue her dreams, she mostly kept out of their way. It saved arguing. But avoidance meant traditions like Christmases, birthdays, weddings, funerals became stilted, demilitarized zones, or battlefields. Why not make an effort, she told herself. Stop by on a pretty Saturday afternoon, touch base, maybe have a drink, admire the garden, pull out a few anecdotes from her travels. How sad and pitiful was it that she needed to outline an agenda to visit her own parents? So she wouldn't. She would handle it just as she had her travels. She'd play it by ear. Somebody's having a big summer party, she thought, noting the cars parked along the street. When she saw a line of them in her parents' long U of a driveway, moored jockeyed into the service area, she realized she'd been about to crash a party. Not the best time for a drop-in, she decided, but hesitated just long enough for one of the valets to block her quick exit. As she waited for the road to clear to make her escape, Natalie and a couple of women in equally elegant garden party dresses crossed the lush green of the front lawn. Appalled that her first instinct was to duck down, she forced a smile on her face when Natalie spotted her. Her sister didn't smile, but tipped her glamour girl sunglasses down to peer over them. And that, for Simone, was that. Deliberately, she pushed open the car door and climbed out in her traveling outfit of army green cargo shorts, red cowboy boots, a wide-brimmed straw hat, and a novelty tank that read, "Red, Wine, and Blue." "Hey, Nat." Natalie said something to her companions that had one of the women patting her arm before they wandered off, not without long, backward glances that clearly transmitted disapproval. Natalie crossed to the sidewalk. She looks like Mom, Simone thought, a perfect example of the polished female.
Simone, we weren't expecting you.
Obviously. I just got back. I thought I'd stop in to say hi.
It's not the best time.
Simone didn't miss the tone. One used for an acquaintance you had to tolerate occasionally.
Also, obviously.
You can tell them I'm back and I'll be at Cece's. I'll give them a call.
That would be novel.
Last I checked, phones work two ways. Anyway, you look great.
Thanks. I'll let Mom and Dad know you.
Natalie! The man who crossed the lawn in the palest of pale gray loafers to match his crisp linen slacks boasted the charm of dimples in a Hollywood handsome face. His elegance, the white shirt topped with a navy blazer, the sun-dashed gold of wavy hair, matched Natalie's perfectly. Though she knew him a little, it took Simone a minute to come up with his name. Harry Harrison Brookfield, one of the young guns in her father's law firm. And according to Cece, Natalie's parentally approved boyfriend.
There you are! I was just... Simone?
Dimples flashing, he held out a hand to shake hers.
I didn't know you were here. This is great. How long have you been back?
About 5 minutes.
Then I bet you could use a drink.
He'd slipped an arm around Natalie's waist as he spoke, and, to Simone's mind, hadn't yet clued in on her stiffness. Then he reached out again for Simone's hand.
Oh, thanks, but I'm not dressed for a party. I'm just going to go, don't be silly.
Harry took a good grip on her hand.
Keys in the car?
Yes, but...
Great.
He signaled to the valet.
Family vehicle.
Really, Harry? Simone's gotta be tired after the drive.
All the more reason she needs that drink.
Like a carpenter's plane wrapped in velvet, he smoothed right over the rough bark.
Now you've got your whole family here to celebrate, sweets.
The man had a grip and a will like iron, Simone thought, but the main reason she allowed him to pull her along, however petty, was Natalie's blatant discomfort. What are we celebrating?
You didn't tell her? Good Lord, Natalie.
Harry looked at Simone, added a wink.
She said yes.
Simone felt her brain empty out for 3 solid seconds.
You're engaged. To be married?
Which makes me the luckiest man in the world.
She heard music now and voices as they started up the walk that would wind through the side garden to the backyard.
Congratulations!
How had it happened? She wondered. How had it happened that the sister who'd once slipped into her bed to whisper secrets hadn't shared such vital, life-changing news? Such happy news that raided a party with elegant dresses and white tablecloths decked with white flowers, with uniformed servers carrying trays of drinks and pretty finger foods.
This is wonderful! Exciting!
You're still so young and so pampered, Simone thought. Are you sure? Would you tell me? Harry stopped a server, took 3 flutes of champagne.
To the wonderful and exciting, he said after he passed them around.
Absolutely. So have you set a date?
October. A year from this October, Natalie said.
I couldn't talk her into the spring. I'll wait. If you'll excuse me a minute, I want to find my mother. She'd love to meet you, Simone. She's especially admired the statue of Natalie holding the scales of justice you made her when she graduated law school. I'll be right back.
You're engaged. God, Nat. Engaged. He's gorgeous, and he seems like a terrific guy.
If you'd bothered to get to know him over the last 2 years, you'd know he is terrific.
I'm happy for you, Simone said carefully. He's obviously crazy about you, and I'm happy for you. If I'd known about the party, I'd have come home sooner, and I'd have dressed appropriately. I'm going to leave. Slip out before I embarrass you.
Simone!
Cece's cheerful shout cut through the music and conversations.
Too late, Natalie stated,
as their grandmother rushed across the patio, gypsy skirts flying.
There's my traveling girl.
She caught Simone in a fierce hug.
Look at you, all toned and tanned. Isn't this a kick in the ass?
She caught Natalie into the hug.
Our baby girl's hooked herself a fiancé, and he is yummy.
She let out one of her big, beautiful laughs, squeezed them both.
Let's drink ourselves a shit ton of champagne.
Mother.
Uh-oh.
Snickering, Cece drew back.
Busted.
She shifted, hooked arms around her granddaughter's waists, and grinned at her daughter.
Look who's here, Tool.
So I see. Simone.
Lovely in silk shantung the color of crushed rose petals, Tulip leaned in to kiss Simone's cheek.
We didn't know you were back.
I just got back.
That explains it.
With her company smile seamless, her eyes sparking annoyance, Tulip turned to Natalie.
Sweetheart, why don't you take your sister upstairs so she can freshen up? I'm sure you have something you can lend her to wear.
Don't be such a buzzkill, Tulip.
Tulip simply turned those sparking eyes on her mother.
This is Natalie's day. I won't have it spoiled.
I won't spoil it. I won't stay. Simone handed her flute to Natalie. Tell Harry I wasn't feeling well.
I'll come with you, Cece began.
No, it's Natalie's day and you should be here. I'll see you later.
That was a dick move, Tulip, Cece said when Simone walked away. And from the look on your face, Nat, apple tree. I'm ashamed of both of you.
Simone had to hunt down the valet who'd parked her car, then wait while he retrieved her keys. While she waited, her father strode briskly down the walkway. Oh well, she thought, what was one more elbow in the gut? Instead, he put his arms around her, drew her close.
Welcome home.
The snipes and jabs hadn't filled her throat with tears, but his gesture did.
Thanks.
I only just heard you'd gotten back, then that you'd left.
You need to come back out, honey. It's a big day for Natalie.
That's why I'm leaving. She doesn't want me here.
That's nonsense.
She made it clear. My unexpected arrival, in attire inappropriate for the occasion, embarrassed your wife and daughter.
You could have come home a bit earlier, worn the appropriate.
I would have if I'd known.
Natalie contacted you 2 weeks ago,
he began, then saw her face. Sighed.
I see. I'm sorry. I'm sorry she indicated she had, otherwise I'd have contacted you myself. Come back with me. I'll have a word with her.
No, don't, please. She doesn't want me here, and I don't want to be here. Sorrow clouded Ward's eyes.
It hurts me to hear you say that.
I'm sorry. I wanted to come by, see you and Mom, to try to turn some of it around. Some of it? I had a good summer. Productive, satisfying, illuminating. I wanted to tell you about it. And maybe you'd see I did the right thing for me. Maybe you'd see that.
I have seen it,
he said quietly.
I've seen I was wrong. I clung to wanting to be right and lost you. And losing you, it was easier to blame you than myself. Now my younger daughter's going to be married. She'll be a wife and not just my little girl. It struck me that with you, I wanted to be right more than I wanted you to be happy. It shames me to look that square in the face, but I have. I hope you'll forgive me.
Daddy. She went into his arms, wept a little. It's my fault, too. It was easier to pull back, to stay away.
Let's agree. I accept I'm not always right, and you don't pull away from me.
She nodded, rested her cheek on his chest. It's a good homecoming after all.
Come on back to the party. Be my date.
I can't. Honestly, Nat bugs the crap out of me, but I don't want to spoil her party. Maybe you could come out to the island sometime, and I'll tell you about the trip and show you some things I'm working on.
All right.
He kissed her forehead.
I'm glad you're back.
So am I. Glad to be back, she thought, especially when she stood at the rail of the ferry and watched the island come closer. Chapter 10 Cece's house offered views of the bay, the ocean beyond, and the tumbled coastline of Tranquility Island, including the jut of rocky land on the far eastern point where the lighthouse perched. When Cece first settled on the island, the lighthouse had been a stark, uninspired white. She'd fixed that. Lobbying with the artists community, she'd convinced the island council, as well as the business and property owners, to kick things up. There had been doubters, of course, at the idea of a group of artists on ladders and scaffolds painting the slender lighthouse with sea flowers, shells, mermaids, sea fans, and coral. But she'd been right. Since its completion, and even during the work, tourists came to snap pictures, and other artists featured the now unique lighthouse in their seascapes. It was a rare visitor who left the island without one or more of the Light of Tranquility souvenirs sold in any number of village and beachside shops. Every few years, the community refreshed the paint and often added another flourish or two. Cece enjoyed looking down the coast, admiring that spear of color and creativity. Her home stood west of the light, on a rise above another jut of the uneven coast. Big windows, stone terraces graced its two stories, plus the converted attic with its little balcony, which made three. A generous patio skirted the waterside, her favorite side, where in season she had dramatic pots of flowers and herbs soaking in the sun, along with oversized chairs with brightly colored cushions and some painted tables. More flowers and comfortable seating ranged along the wide terrace on the second floor. It also held a hot tub, which she used year-round, under a pergola where she often lounged, happily naked, with a glass of wine, while watching the water and the boats that plied it. She could enter her studio with its bay-facing wall of glass,
designed and added after she'd bought the house, from the great room or the patio. She loved painting there when the water gleamed blue as a jewel, or when it went icy gray and thrashing in the grip of a winter storm. She'd converted the attic, or Jasper